This is a Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report special. I'm Ken Nash.
And I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
Later on Building Bridges, author Larry Tye, who has written Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class, a much-deserved tribute to the forgotten men of the civil rights and labor movements. The Pullman Porters defeated a major corporation, helped finance numerous civil rights battles, spread news and culture nationwide, and set a high standard for dignity.
There's only a few of the original Pullman Porters left, men of tremendous capability, men of tremendous dignity. Indeed, as one was coming out of slavery, it was many of the slaves that actually had the technological, that had the mechanical capabilities and know-how, and yet they were put in positions that continued to be subservient based on white supremacy.
And now an excerpt from the video, Abe Philip Randolph for Jobs and Freedom. Randolph was the president of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters.
In the 19th century, the railroad companies were the biggest corporations in America. They were organized in a military fashion. From their view, workers were expected to obey orders and shut up.
A giant among the railway industry people was George Pullman and the Pullman Company. And what Pullman did was to get a monopoly on a unique kind of feature, which was the Pullman car. Which is in effect what he called a kind of home on wheels, or kind of palace on wheels. And Pullman made millions and millions of dollars off owning these cars and then leasing them to the railroads, and then providing black people as servants on these cars.
The Pullman car porter was a job created for freed slaves. The Pullman Company saw the ex-slaves as well-trained servants, experienced at attending to every whim of rich whites. By 1920, the Pullman Company was the largest employer of blacks in the nation.
When I started working for the Pullman Company, and this was classified as one of the best jobs, you didn't have any problems getting credit, and you always had a check coming, and they paid their bills and everything, and it was one of those things that it was a good job.
Honey, you sure is wonderful in them clothes.
Yeah, I suppose his clothes is something to look at. Babe.
In the film Emperor Jones, Paul Robeson played a Pullman porter, a worker who had some money and traveled the nation.
The porters wore caps with the sign on the front of them that said porter. But people had come by custom to ignore the idea of calling them porter, and had come to calling all of the porters George. George was the first name of George Mortimer Pullman, the founder of the company, and this again demonstrates the pervasiveness of that man.
So they had no rights that the Pullman Company or any passenger, and in those days all the passengers were Caucasians, so the porters didn't have a single right that anyone had to respect, and of course they didn't.
In the early 20s, Pullman porters were earning about $15 per week for working more than 80 hours each week. Their meager wages were supplemented by tips. To get these tips, porters had to bow and offer a lot of yes ma'ams and yes sirs to white travelers. That led some to criticize them as Uncle Toms.
The porter played the role of Uncle Tom to an advantage that he made money out of it. You got a whole lot of people play the role of Uncle Tom and don't get nothing out of it. Yeah, and the role that a whole lot of porters played, he played it to the advantage, and the white man paid for it.
Complaints over pay and working hours spread quickly down the rail lines. Some porters began to discuss creating a union to replace the weak company-controlled union that currently represented them. Randolph kept the messenger filled with talk of blacks joining the union movement. He wrote stinging critiques of white industrialists and continued to attack the black upper class for its support of capitalism. His writings brought him to the porters' attention. They asked him to create a genuine union to represent them.
The group that came and decided they wanted to organize a union determined, and I think with a streak of brilliance, that in order to organize the union, they needed somebody to lead it who was outside the reach of the Pullman Company. They found that man in a street corner orator and publicist named A. Philip Randolph.
We are very pleased to have brought just that little clip to set the pace and to have with us now Larry Tye, author of Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters, and the Making of the Black Middle Class. And we welcome you to WBAI.
Nice to be with you.
I don't know how many of our listeners know that probably the most famous Pullman Porter was Malcolm X. And I wanted to begin by a quote from Malcolm. He said, "It didn't take me a week to learn that all you had to do was give white people a show and they'd buy anything you offered them. It was like popping your shoeshine rag. The dining car waiters and Pullman porters knew it too, and they faked their Uncle Tommy'ing to get bigger tips. We were in the world of Negroes who were both servants and psychologists, aware that white people are so obsessed with their own importance that they will pay liberally, even dearly, for the impression of being catered to and entertained." And in some ways, that quote seemed to me to show the delicate balance between the tremendous capabilities of the Pullman Porter, their dedication to their service, their strength, their dignity, and the situation that they were in, which was indeed catering to people who, in most instances, were profoundly racist.
That's true. And as Malcolm X said in that quote, he only worked in the trains for a short time, but he learned more lessons, racism and of how to get along between the races during that short time than in just about anything he did for his life after that. And it was really quite extraordinary, and he wasn't the only one learning those lessons.
Larry, what was the racial separation of the workforce on the railroads and within the Pullman Company, and how did that develop?
It was 2 years after the end of the Civil War that George Pullman had the idea of starting this extraordinary sleeping car service. And he reasoned that if he could come up with the perfect, comfortable way for people to travel on long distances across the country and to actually be able to sleep during their trip, that he could charge them twice the price of a normal train ticket. But he also was smart enough to understand that he needed the perfect servant to take care of him on that long trip across country. And what better place to look for the perfect servant than among the recently freed 8 million slaves? And George Pullman hired only blacks, only ex-slaves, from a handful of the biggest slave states in America to work on the Pullman car. The good news was, for the next 100 years, African Americans had a monopoly on the job of Pullman Porter. The bad news was they couldn't rise to be a conductor or any other of the better jobs on a train.
Maybe you can describe for us some of the day-to-day activity and work of the Pullman Porters.
Your listeners should imagine every job they can think of in a hotel, from chambermaid to janitor, from bellman to the guy who shined your shoes in the middle of the night. And the Pullman Porter did every one of those jobs. They acted as nursemaid when a passenger got drunk. They acted as doctor when somebody got sick. They were the seamstress when you ripped your dress or your pants on a long trip across country. And they did it all not just with a smile, which was required, but they did it all with a sense of ultimate discretion. If they saw something during that trip that you wouldn't want them to ever repeat, like maybe you ended up in the berth of somebody other than your spouse. The porter was guaranteed to keep his lips sealed forever.
And they got paid well as the conductors, and they got time and a half, and how many hours did they work, and what were the working conditions like?
George Pullman had this whole thing scoped out. He paid them just below what it cost to make a living, which guaranteed that they would have to cater to every passenger need, because they would depend on those passengers for a tip. Many of them actually doubled their salary over the years with tips, and he worked them as many hours as he could, which turned out, in the case of the average porter for the first 30 or so years, to be 100 hours a week, 400 hours a month, and it's really quite extraordinary. Basically, he understood that these were people who had been used to the horribly oppressive system of slavery, and he gave them just enough better to make them grateful, but enough to remind them that they were still servants.
Larry, how do you assess the rather complicated character of the black porter within the context of black history? What is the role they played? What is the significance?
There are really three things that we should remember them for as we look at them 100 years after they started their service. The first big thing they gave us was the first successful African-American trade union in the country's history. A guy named A. Philip Randolph picked up where porters before him had tried and failed to start a union. He started out with them in 1925. 12 years to the day after they hired him, the Pullman Company came in and shockingly signed a contract with him. And it wasn't just that he was the first black trade union. He was fighting against what may have been the most anti-union company in America. Number two, a really quick story I'd like to tell you about the porter's role in civil rights. It takes us back to 1955, and all your listeners know what happened in Montgomery, Alabama, when Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat to a white passenger. She was arrested and taken down to the local jail. What they may not know is that her first phone call was to a guy that she worked for named Edgar D. Nixon, and she asked him to come and bail her out. Edgar Nixon ran the local office of the NAACP, and he was a Pullman porter, and he ran the local office of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. She called Nixon because Nixon had been waiting for years for the perfect test case to challenge the Jim Crow segregated system of busing in Montgomery. The next morning after Rosa was arrested, Nixon got on the telephone and called 19 black ministers to ask them to come to a meeting to talk about organizing against this segregated busing system. The third guy he called was a young minister who just moved there from my native Boston, and his name was Martin King. Nixon said, "Reverend King, will you come to a meeting to talk about boycotting the buses?" King was new to town and wasn't quite sure what to do, so he said, "Call me back, I'll think about it." Nixon calls the 18 other ministers, and then he calls back King and says, "Will you come?" King says, "Okay, I will." Nixon says, "That's great, because I've invited 18 other ministers to your church tomorrow at 3 o'clock, and I'm glad you'll be there." The point of this story is that the guy who would have run the Montgomery bus boycott was Edgar D. Nixon, and he really did run it behind the scenes. But he was a Pullman porter and spending too many days and nights on the road to actually be there as the upfront guy running every meeting. So he asked Martin Luther King to do it, this young minister. I tell you this story because this is a metaphor for what the porters did throughout the civil rights movement. When they donated their union halls for civil rights meetings, they donated their union money when the movement had no money, and most importantly, they donated leaders like Edgar Nixon and A. Philip Randolph, who had spent all these years battling the Pullman Company and knew how to run the civil rights movement when young civil rights leaders weren't sure. And number three, and most importantly, they gave us their sons and daughters, who I think today play a disproportionate role in forming the leadership of African America. And I'm talking about people like Thurgood Marshall, the first black Supreme Court justice, who worked on the trains as a porter himself and whose dad put him through college with his job as a porter. I'm talking about Tom Bradley, the first African American mayor of a major American city, L.A., or Willie Brown, who recently retired as the African-American mayor of San Francisco. Bradley and Brown were the sons of Pullman porters. Disproportionately, whether they're leaders of science and law, of politics and medicine, African-Americans of stature were disproportionately the children and grandchildren of Pullman porters. That's the third and the most profound legacy.
I guess that's the rise of the middle class, which is part of the title. I just wanted to return for a moment before we continue with A. Philip Randolph and the building of the Union and so on, with that very delicate balance, that thin line between having to really sell yourself and to maximize tips, and the relationship of the correlation between slavery and economic freedom. I mean, how do you see the porters balancing that kind of contradiction that was thrust upon them throughout their work life?
I see them having balanced it very delicately, and I think quite brilliantly, that on the one hand, they had to do a lot of things to ensure that their family would have the funds that they needed to survive. They had to do a lot of things that required their absorbing a lot of humiliation. And on the most sort of basic and obvious level, you could see it in the names that they were called. They were called the N-word, they were called boy, and most hurtful of all, they were called George, which was a name that porters as a whole group were called because of the insidious tradition passed down from slavery, where slaves were named after their slave masters, and they were presumed to be George Pullman slaves. So they had to absorb this perpetual humiliation, and yet they all learned how to don a mask the same way any black who grew up in the last 100 years in America did, so as not to show their true feelings and so as not to let themselves truly become vulnerable. And they learned among themselves to have a whole code of ethics, to even have their own separate language so that they could maintain their humanity in the face of the humiliation. And it was, again, what African Americans throughout that era had to do. What was unique among the Pullman porters is, if you were a maid, a black maid in a white home, or you worked in a white factory on a white farm, at night you could go home and let down your guard. As a Pullman porter, you were on the train at times for weeks at a time, and you could never let down the guard or take off that mask. So they were quite extraordinary men who, very sadly, often later in life, were thought of by much of black America as Uncle Toms, when in fact, as we've discussed, they were the ones who got the whole civil rights movement started in very profound ways.
And they also, of course, took on and unionized against one of the most anti-union companies of its time, the Pullman Company. As we're talking these days about what we need to do to get the labor movement into a movement again, what do you think we can learn from the unionization efforts of the Pullman porters back in the 1920s?
We could, as you suggest, we can learn that basically nobody's ever had to take on a more intransigent group of corporate leaders than the Pullman porters did, and nobody's ever had their hands tied behind their back the way the Pullman porters did, not only because they were African-American, but because the wider labor union spurned them and wouldn't let them into their unions. And I think what we can learn is a profound lesson that at the beginning of Black History Month, I was at the AFL-CIO, and the president of the AFL-CIO, John Sweeney, unveiled an exhibit of all the pictures from this book that he felt were an important symbol for the labor movement today. They now are hanging in the lobby at AFL-CIO headquarters, and I think even Sweeney, in his attempt to try to revive a moribund labor movement, is trying to learn from the inspired lessons of the Pullman porters, who made it work with everything working against them, suggesting that workers today have to fight hard and learn from these porters.
We'll see how well Mr. Sweeney does on the incorporation of people of African ancestry into the leadership and takes the lessons that were learned there and transplants them into organizing today.
And you've written a number of books on a number of different subjects. You were a journalist. Why did you decide, why does this topic fascinate you this much?
Like you two, I'm a journalist at heart, and basically we're always looking for the perfect little story that tells a bigger story, that offers us a lens into a bigger story. To me, the Pullman porters were the perfect small story of these men who at their height never numbered more than 12,000, and yet they capture to me quite brilliantly the larger story of the all-American success. They rose from being ex-slaves to being leaders of America. And I think that it was just an irresistible story that I found made for a captivating topic for me for the year and a half I spent on it.
And what has been the response to the book? I know Ken's response and my response is extremely positive, and we would encourage people definitely to get this book, Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class.
Most rewarding response was a response from the Porters themselves. They are, as you say, they're in their 90s now, some of them are in their early hundreds, and they were so delighted to have their story rescued before they died, and seeing the response me made everything worthwhile. The sad thing is that at the rate of about once a month, I get a phone call telling me that another Pullman Porter that I got to know has died. But most of them survived long enough to at least see the book and to give me wonderful responses to the story that I tried to tell. Baltimore Washington International Airport is being named after, renamed the Thurgood Marshall Airport. And in doing this...
Oh, hooray, hooray. Wonderful. Wonderful.
Yes, that is wonderful. The irony is they're doing it and they're celebrating his life as a porter and his dad's having been a porter. It's ironic that they chose an airport to name after him, but in a way it's a sign of how sad we are today in our lack of support for railroads, but at least we're remembering Marshall and his contributions and his work on the train.
I want to return to A. Philip Randolph. He was the prime organizer of the 1963 March on Washington, which most people attribute to Martin Luther King. But do lift up more about the role of A. Philip Randolph in organizing this group of people into this magnificent union.
He did a spectacular job of organizing this union, and he did it in spite of the efforts of the Pullman Company, not just to fight a union, but they actually were quite brilliant in the ways they did that. They donated money to black churches, to YMCAs in the black community, with the understanding that the heads of the Y and the ministers would preach from the pulpit how good and how generous the Pullman Company was. He took them on and beat them at their psychological warfare. He did it by his eloquence. He did it by his persistence. One of the things that we have to learn from Randolph is that he understood that key to organizing black workers was not just organizing for their narrow rights as laborers and to have a union, but for more basic human rights. And I'd like your listeners to think, the next time we celebrate Martin Luther King's birthday and we rightfully celebrate him as a father of the civil rights movement, I'd like them to think about A. Philip Randolph as the grandfather. And you talked about the famous 1963 March on Washington. Well, A. Philip Randolph had first threatened a large march on Washington back in the days when Franklin Roosevelt was president.
And I think 1941.
Exactly, and he called it off only because Roosevelt gave in to his demands, and he was perpetually there, starting with Calvin Coolidge and going through Lyndon Johnson, meeting with American presidents, forcing the hand of the federal government to give in on basic issues of civil rights and economic justice. And he was really quite an extraordinary leader for 60 years.
I encourage our listeners to read Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters, and the Making of the Black Middle Class by Larry Tye.
And we'll end with another clip from the film, a message Randolph delivered to the first Porters Union meeting, which is as relevant for us today as for the Porters then.
On August 25, 1925, Randolph arranged a secret meeting with the Porters at the Imperial Lodge of Elks on 129th Street in Harlem. 500 attended.
Because there was great fear among the Porters, you know, that stool pigeons would penetrate the meeting and carry news back to the superintendent, to who was there. And the superintendents were ruthless and would fire a porter if he had the slightest idea that he was trying to become a part of a union. And then I got up and told them, you have to take responsibility upon your own shoulders, building something upon which you can depend, that you get what you can take and keep what you can hold. You can't take anything without power, and you can't hold anything without power. And you can't get power unless you're organized. You could hear a pin fall because it was looked upon as simply hopeless to try to organize a group of men who were under the grip, the moral and intellectual and economic grip of a mighty corporation such as the Pullman Company was.
our voices high. We'll join our hands in union strong to battle or to die.
The following day, more than 200 men poured into the messenger's office to join the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters Union.
This has been Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report special filed for Wake Up Call.
Once each time I see, I've got the full Pullman Porter blues.